Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3799, we saw before on the 4th of April. In your packets, please find the staff measure summary, 2 pages long. Summary, a dash 5 amendment, which is 3 pages long, and a couple of references from the Oregon Revised Statute that I'll explain here in a minute. What I've done, members of the committee, and the effect of the committee amendments portion of the staff measure summary, essentially the dash 5 amendment replaces the original bill, and what I've done is I've put in bold language those sorts of additional things that you haven't seen before with regard to this bill. If I could ask you to get your amendment in front of you, and then I'll just briefly go over each part of that amendment with you.
You're on the dash 5?
Dash 5 amendment. The section number 2 defines electricity provider and limits the scope of the bill to an investor-owned electric utility company. With one of the first photocopy of the utility regulation, page 46, I've circled electric company and electricity service supplier from the Oregon Revised Statute so that you can understand that they're creating a new definition, and that new definition, again, is electricity provider, and that's in section 2, and essentially it is a combination of electric company found at subsection 11 and electricity service supplier, which is subsection 16. Bottom line is it means that the bill applies to investor-owned utility electric companies only.
So investor-owned, utility-owned.
That's correct.
In Oregon, of which there are 3.
That's correct. Okay. Section number 3, essentially you've seen all of that before, and again, that requires an electric public utility to sell not less than 4% of the total power sold as non-hydroelectric power, renewable power, not later than July 1st, 2003, same as the basic bill. The next section requires increasing amounts of non-hydroelectric renewable power to be sold not less than 7% and 10%, not later than July 1st, 2007, 2000, 2005, and then 2007, respectively. Section 3, sub 2, limits the charge for providing non-hydroelectric power an electric public utility may sell at 8 cents per kilowatt hour for any combination of geothermal, biomass, and wind technologies, and 25 cents per kilowatt hour for solar technology. And the additional piece here is only if the provider is able to acquire any of those types of non-hydroelectric power. So again, that's in bold language.
Is that a wholesale price? Now I read it. Only if the provider is able to acquire the power.
At those prices, so it would have to be at a wholesale price.
Okay, which 8 cents an hour is.
Section 3, sub 3, indexes that the non-hydroelectric power annual price increase or decrease to 50 percentile of the net change in the Portland Consumer Price Index. In the original bill, this was 40% of the variable portion of that Consumer Price Index. The requester of the amendment has simplified that to simply 50% of the net increase or decrease in the consumer Portland Consumer Price Index.
Do you know why they wanted 50%?
He'd like to explain that in his testimony, please. Section 3, sub 4, provides that the PUC may allow an electricity provider operating in more than one state to recover expenditures to produce or acquire non-hydroelectric power that was disallowed in another state in rates for Oregon customers. Again, this is for multi-state type companies who, in fact, may have been denied by the utility commission in those other states. They may have been disallowed to recover those costs. This would provide an incentive for the state of Oregon to allow them to recover those costs in the rates that Oregon customers pay.
Is that true even if this power is sold in another state?
That's correct. It's only for the power that is sold for that company if it sells power in another state and in this state.
Yeah, but the question is, if I'm reading this, does it mean that if they acquire power and they sell this non-renewable energy in another state and the other state doesn't allow them to recover the costs associated with that sale, that Oregon then allows them to recover the costs for the energy that was sold into another state?
Yes, it doesn't disassociate, it doesn't distinguish between which state. It just simply says those disallowed expenditures. Even if the power is sold in another state, I guess.
Well, I think it's sold in this state. This is, has made the expenditures in another state to produce or acquire the non-hydro renewable energy to meet the requirements of this section.
Okay.
Okay, we'll get some testimony.
Okay.
Section four?
Section four imposes a penalty for non-compliance of 3 cents for each kilowatt hour not sold in compliance with this act, and directs that these funds, and this is new to the, in this amendment, added to the development of renewable energy resources account within the public purpose charge allocated in other section of the statute. And I've included a photocopy of page 49 of the Oregon Revised Statute 757 that talks about the 19% for above market cost for new renewable energy resources. That's where that money would go to. In essence, the original bill had a green power account and a green power board, and the Dash 5 amendment eliminates those.
All right, so is that language from 1149?
It is.
Which section, 4?
4 sub 1 of the amendment, which would be toward the bottom of page 2. On the bottom of page 2, section 4 sub 2 allows the PUC to direct an electricity provider to set aside amounts as penalties by an order entered after a hearing. It exempts the requirement to set aside if the failure to comply was out of the beyond the control of the electricity provider. Again, this allows the PUC to allow the utility to start building up funds to pay penalties, and if in fact conducts a hearing and determines that the circumstances were out of the control of the electricity provider, exempts them from being required to have a hearing and to hold those funds separate. Section 5 at the top of page 3 allows an electricity provider to change rates without a PUC hearing to allow recovery, to recover the incremental cost of buying and delivering non-hydroelectric power as directed in this act. Section 6 requires that within 1 year of acquiring an electricity provider by reason of condemnation, the new electricity supplier will meet requirements of this act. Specifically, that is in relation to an investor-owned utility being bought by another electricity supplier. In fact, by reason of condemnation, certain electricity providers are allowed to condemn an electricity utility and, in fact, buy that or assume it or at least assume the service. And what it says, if that happens by reason of condemnation, the new electricity supplier will meet the requirements of this act. On line 16 of section 6 on page 3, line 16, after the words condemnation on line 15, and the new supplier is not an electricity provider, that just simply is a disclaimer for an electricity provider who buys or somehow assumes control of the previous electricity provider. That was a little confusing to me, and I had to check on that. But in fact, it just means that the new electricity provider buys or assumes control of the old electricity provider. They're already covered by this act anyway. They're already required to provide the non-hydroelectric power in accordance with the dates in the first section.
I don't understand section 6. I mean, by reason of condemnation, what is that referring to?
There are certain types of municipal utilities that have the right to condemn certain properties and certain activities within their jurisdiction. And this would allow, and so if in fact there was an attempt made to condemn an electricity provider, those municipal electricity utilities would still have to comply with this act. That's what it says with regard to if they got it by reason of condemnation. If they purchased or assumed control of the electricity provider by reason of condemnation. Section 7 exempts electricity providers servicing fewer than 25,000 Oregon customers in this state.
That's that Idaho Power?
That's the Idaho Power.
Yeah. Which section?
That's in section 7 on page 3.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates?
Dan, could you give me a section that comes a little vague on that? Could you give me an example of how that exactly works?
I can, but it wouldn't be accurate, Representative Bates. Yeah, I'd like Mr. Vannetta to speak to that because, again, in my research, this was probably the most complex part of the what I was able to understand.
I understand there are some other amendments that have been offered.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is potentially a Dash 4 that one of the that Representative Monis Anderson would like to speak to as well.
Do you want to briefly talk about that?
Okay, I am introducing dash four, and primarily because this bill affects my constituents, which is PG is my supplier of electricity in Gresham. And it's important to me, I think it's good public policy if we would have this, a standard, a set standard for the state of Oregon for renewables. And I say that because California, they don't have a standard, but 12% of their generation of utility generation is from renewables. And Nevada has, I forget what Nevada has, I think you told me, 15, a standard of 15. The state of Oregon has a standard of 2, actually 1, but we have a 2%, I mean, 2% of the generation is from renewables. So I introduced 4 because I feel that we need to have a standard for everybody, not just for PGE customers and for PacifiCorp customers. I want it for all suppliers of power. And so that's why I introduced dash 4. I think this bill has gotten extremely complicated. And from a policy standpoint, I wish it would, even with my amendment, it would be simpler, because I think there are aspects of the change of the bill that make it very, very complicated. We have, if our public purposes goes through, we are then going to be generating around 60 or 70 million for renewables. And now with this bill, we would be adding another tax on to constituents for PGE and PacifiCorp. So it's very complicated, and but I introduced dash 4, and basically all it does is change the word so that we are using the word, let me get it out here, changing a public utility to an electric utility, and basically that's the major change.
Johnson?
It's a question for Representative Monis Anderson. Would you contemplate that this would include municipals, public utility districts, all?
All.
Thank you.
If we are changing, if we're doing a policy change for the state of Oregon, I think everyone in the state of Oregon needs to be pulling their weight. And we need to get renewables in. I mean, we have, for instance, in Representative Canope's district, he has a lot of geothermal power from the volcanoes, right? We need to be using more wind, more biomass, more solar, fuel cells, and so let's do it statewide. Let's make a big statement for the state of Oregon. That's why I did it.
Representative Canope?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With great respect to the good representative from Gresham, having been the co-sponsor or being the co-sponsor of the bill, I see the dash 4 as more as of a poison pill than a help. And the reason for that is because the co-ops and the municipalities get nearly all their power from BPA. Unless BPA is going to fly kites and put windmills on top of their dams, there's no possible way that they could ever meet the goal. And the two big power companies cover about 75% of the population of the state of Oregon as it relates to energy. So I think this is a pretty good place to start, and I do represent part of Pacific Power Territory, so I would oppose it, actually.
Yeah, Representative, I think one of the, I appreciate where you're going with this. You may create a constitutional problem on the floor.
And just as a follow-up, this is something I think that we should be addressing even during the interim, because as I said, this is extremely complicated, and there's no reason that there can't be a delay for consumer owned investment and consumer owned utilities.
Representative Brock.
Mr. Chair, who came up with the dash 5? Who's responsible for that?
I think Mr. Van Atta and Representative Knuth. Okay. And people that Mr. Van Atta has been working with. other comments? If not, we'll take some testimony on the amendments to the bill. Fred, you want to come up?
I will maybe just remind you momentarily as to why the bill is before you. Our renewable portfolio standard would signal Oregon's commitment to protect our salmon, our environment, and provide electric ratepayers with some insulation from the ever-increasing cost of natural gas. This is a good measure. It doesn't solve all the problems, but it's a step in the right direction. I would be happy to answer specific questions. I think one that I understood that was hanging was related to Section 6 and a question about an example. If I understand the law correctly, the city of Portland, for example, could decide to start their own electric utility and condemn after an appropriate vote and charter changes and all the things they might do, could then condemn the privately owned poles and wire within the city limits and run their own utility. The thrust of Measure 6 is that if they did that, they would be bound by the green power portfolio that this legislation would create.
Oh, so in other words, if a government entity used its condemnation power to take over a portion of a private utility.
Under adverse circumstances.
Like the city of Portland tried to buy part of PG, and they used condemnation to do it, bought it, then they would be bound by the requirements here to provide these renewable resources.
That is correct. And frankly, the reason for it is, while nobody knows in 203 what the price of power is going to be, there is the belief of, on the part of at least some that the renewable energy may be slightly more expensive than we believe over the long term. Having a renewable portfolio will help hold costs down. But in the early stages of the implementation of this, some of the renewables may cost a little more. And people could use that increased cost as an excuse to go to their government and try to get them to condemn the utility. This protects the private sector from that, because if they did that, they would have to meet the same standard.
Okay, I understand. Representative Johnson?
Thank you. Mr. Bennett, from your testimony, you just said that this would protect the ratepayers from the rising cost of natural gas, and I find your protection for the ratepayers laudable. Would you explain to me then how Section 5 of this bill and Section 3, Sub 4 are consumer friendly and protect the ratepayers?
Well, Section 5 allows the utility to, if there are increased costs to get to acquire the green power necessary to meet these standards, it passes those costs directly on to the ratepayers. That is the thrust of Section 5.
Do you think that's a consumer-friendly position? And how about, let's go back and talk about Section 3, Sub 4.
Regarding the Mold Estate utility, I will ask the representatives of Scottish Power to explain how that works, and because that is their draft. They had not seen Section 5 when they prepared their Sub 4. I got to thinking about it after sitting in the room today that. Section 5 may solve their problem, but their representatives can speak to Sub 4 of Section 3.
Well, my read on both of those sections is this comes right back and sticks it to the consumers in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is terribly consumer unfriendly.
Representative Garrard.
I'd like to follow up on Representative Johnson's question. Fred, in Section 5, line 10 through 13, I want to make sure I'm reading this right. It says the commission shall allow a change in rates under this section without a review of the electricity provider's earnings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And who's going to regulate this? Who's going to stop this from going anywhere it wants to go?
My understanding of the point is you don't do a rate hearing. When these kick in and you buy the renewables, you don't go into a rate hearing. It talks about the actual incremental cost, and at the next rate hearing, the PUC can review the increase that was allowed, and frankly, the way I understand this language is supposed to work, if the data given the PUC wasn't correct, if the PUC allowed a greater increase than was the actual incremental increase in cost, that can be dealt with at the subsequent rate hearing. But the idea is you don't freeze everything in place and have a rate hearing because you bought renewables under this mandatory statutory requirement that you provide your customers with renewable energy.
So in other words, these increases in rates would be subject to review at some point down the road if the increase was over and beyond what was the PUC determined was necessary to meet the additional costs imposed by this bill upon the utility.
That's my understanding, the actual incremental cost. If it isn't the actual incremental cost, this section doesn't apply to it.
Okay, other questions, Mr. Yes. Van Anna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know what percentage of the consumers in the state of Oregon use PG and PacifiCorp? Because they are the ones that are going to be affected by this.
I do not know that figure precisely. I heard the vice chair of the committee quote a figure, which I presume was based on good information that he had received.
About 75%, Representative.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's about 75%. Idaho Power might be in that figure, but it's very small.
There are some experts in the room who probably know the precise numbers. I do not.
That's a pretty good number.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
A couple of questions real quick, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd echo Representative Johnson's concerns about some parts of the bill, and we are running short of time now. We've only got the week now to make any changes, and I'm concerned about these. Also concerned that several of the amendments refer back to ORS 756 and 757, and I believe, Dan, you said that is tied into 1149?
Yes, Representative Bates. A lot of stuff there, though.
Yeah.
With regard to public purpose charges.
Yeah, my concern is 1149 ends up being delayed or stopped at this point. How does it affect this bill?
May I speak to that? The principal thing that ties back to 1149 are the penalty provisions, and they don't. This nothing kicks in. Nothing happens until July of 2003, and no penalty would be assessed for. Because the penalty would require a PUC rate action probably a year after July of 2003. So if 1149 was delayed for more than 4 years, or if 1149 was repealed, there's plenty of opportunity to remedy that in a future session. The language, Legislative Council drafted the language, so it's at least theoretically possible that it would stand without 1149 because it talks about the kind of a process and the PUC has rate-making authority. So whether it would require a legislative fix or not, I don't know, but there will be another legislative session come and gone before the penalty question arises at all.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Monis-Anderson, then Representative Johnson.
Thank you. We're going to be hopefully having public purposes money which, what is it, 11 cents on each, every consumer, or 3 cents, I forget what it is. Why, rather than having extra money coming out of 75% of the people in Oregon, why couldn't those corporations or agencies or electric utility companies apply through whatever processes is going to result from the public purposes money? Why do we have to have two systems now? Because half of our public purposes money is going to be dedicated to renewables. And so that is a tax that will be on our consumers. So why couldn't those agencies interested in renewables go through that process?
Actually, the 19% of the 3% public purposes, I believe, is what's
is that what
is
it
what
is
earmarked
60
for
or 70 million,
for
something like that.
Cost renewable resources. Certainly, the utilities, as they go to buy the renewable energy to meet this standard, could go to the PUC and apply for that renewable money to help them pay for above cost. And to the extent they did that, they would have less or no actual increase in cost. The bad news is the amount of money in that fund isn't very large. I think the $50 or $60 million figure that was quoted is, if I understand it correctly, is all the money and not the 19%. The actual money for renewables is a good deal smaller than the $50 or $60 million a year that we talked about. If my information understanding is correct.
Okay.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you. Mr. Van Etten, would you not agree that this has been one of the most volatile electric markets in certainly recent memory, but maybe ever? Take out ever. How about recent?
About a year.
If the Oregon electricity market had been fairly stable, in recent times, there is certainly, particularly given the California situation and the what's now happening in the last year with the increase in the price of natural gas and our reliance on Canadian natural gas to provide our future electricity, we're headed into a period of some uncertainty about exactly what the rates will be. I don't argue that in the slightest.
Well, if we're headed into a period of uncertainty, as you just stated, how prudent is it for this legislature to set in statutes fixed percentages of electricity that should be generated by non-hydroelectric renewable sources?
We believe it's very prudent because those prices will be much more stable over time than the price of Canadian natural gas, and it will kickstart those industries in Oregon and significantly over time contribute to the stability of electric prices.
Where's your guarantee or evidence of stability?
One of the guarantee, if you will, is the price cap built into the bill about the utilities' purchase of the electricity from green sources. If they cannot acquire it at the price caps that are in this bill, they don't have to follow the standards set forth. And that is a significant contribution to price stability.
How about availability in toto? Availability of green power?
Well, we believe if the utilities step out to, if this standard goes into place, we believe the power will be there. If it isn't there, they don't. If it isn't there, they don't have to buy. They're not obligated to buy it. We believe it'll be there.
How does it say they're not obligated to buy it, though, when you fix percentages?
Well, there is a provision that says if it's not available for reasons beyond the control of the provider, see the top of page 3, failure to meet the requirements of section 3 was due to circumstances beyond the control of the provider. They do not have to, they're not bound by the law.
Any other questions for Mr. Bates?
I want to ask you some basic questions here. What is the cost per kilowatt hour prior to our recent upswing? Was it about 3 or 4 cents an hour? What is the present cost of electricity for most people buying the retail market right now? About 3 or 4 cents an hour?
Less than that.
Should be some experts in the room that are better able. There's a gentleman from the PUC here who may have a better answer.
I think Representative testimony on this bill a few weeks ago that was in the area of 2 to 3 cents in terms of cost of service rates. Of course, the spot market price is many times that.
And so if I'm reading this correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're talking about 8 cents per kilowatt hour for non-solar and 25 cents for solar. And if I'm reading correctly, it'll go up by 50% of the CPI as the years go by. Is that correct?
That is correct.
What would be effective if we went to a full 4% at 25 cents per kilowatt hour on the overall cost of electricity to consumers at this point? Would we see a substantial rise? Talking about 4%? But we're talking about a huge increase in kilowatt cost.
One of the folks that are with me did some calculations on that. I have not tried to calculate. That cost.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I want to be sure I understand another section too that the good Representative Johnson mentioned, section 3. Four, if I'm reading it correctly, again, correct if I'm wrong. In simple terms, I believe this says that if green power is produced, as an example, in Utah, and the state of Utah has not got a law saying that it has to be bought there, that this would require the consumers in Oregon to pay for that green power in Utah. Is that correct?
I do not believe that is correct. The author of that can speak more specifically to it, but that's not my understanding of what it does.
Oh, yeah. Sean, did you?
I think it does say that. That's when they may be buying power in both states, but if green power is produced in another state, then this state would be required to buy it off if the other state doesn't do it. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent Pacific Corp. Electric utility that operates in Oregon as Pacific Power. I'll comment on the Section 4. We worked with Mr. Van Ad on this particular amendment in this provision in this bill, and it's something we've worked on in other states that were considering these portfolio standards. For instance, Washington was considering a criteria portfolio standard, and they did not do that this session. But as in PacifiCorp's case, we operate as a multi-state utility. Our company operates in Washington, Idaho, Utah, Wyoming, Montana, for example. And as an incentive, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, to meet this criteria in sections 3 of the particular bill of the renewable energy sources, if we build a wind facility, for an example, and even here to provide to meet the standards within this bill, if this were law. And Utah, for example, says when we build that facility, says that that was not a good investment for the company, only because Utah law doesn't provide these standards or these portfolio requirements for a renewable. So they say we're not going to recover any of your cost, and yet we had to build that to stay under these requirements. We're not going to ship them electricity because they're not going to be able. We're not going to be able to recover our cost there. However, that energy is going to Oregon customers. This just says that the Public Utility Commission may allow recovery of those of that investment through Oregon customers to meet the requirements within the law. That was our intent of the bill. Now, you know, I know we got this to Fred, and it is in the amendments, and it makes us neutral on the particular bill. If you remember correctly from the first hearing, we did oppose the bill. This was something as a protection. Now, we, as a company, our incentive to build renewables, and we're doing so now. We're probably going to have the next phase of our wind facility on the board, and some more projects in the future coming up real soon. However, this is something that is a big deal to us. It probably wouldn't have been a big deal only and when our company breaks up because of deregulation. Restructuring, we're actually breaking up the generation side and the regulated side, and all of our states will be individually broken up. We're going through that process, a long process, and it wouldn't be, this wouldn't be such a big deal once that happens, but it is now since we're just a multi-state utility regulated by all those public utility commissions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think your answer was yes.
I think so.
Thank you. So in simple terms, if we have expensive green power in another state and that state doesn't have this kind of regulation in, that will allow a company like yours to shift that cost into this state on our rate payers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, only because there is a requirement for us.
I understand the ethos. That could happen. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, but the requirement, Sean, so I understand it, so that you can meet the requirement that the appropriate percentage is dictated by this bill is sold of non-hydro renewable in Oregon, right?
That's correct.
So these are expenditures that you're incurring to sell this power in Oregon.
That's correct.
Right. So why wouldn't it be appropriate that those costs would go with Oregon regulations? I don't know why they wouldn't.
My reasoning is this, is that if the people in Oregon would be paying more for the rates because of going for what's called green power of any type, instead of being shared throughout the grid because other states, let's say Washington, Idaho, Utah, California, all decide we're not going to green power, but we pass a law here requiring 10% green power, then anything done with other states, a large utility would offload those costs back in Oregon. Oregon taxpayers would pay a fair share of the burden of green power. And be a very small amount of 4%, but you understand the reasoning there. It's not shared equal. Same problem with putting in enterprise zones here to produce more power. If the other states don't do it, again, because of lost taxes, Oregonians pay more. And that's what I'm concerned about. It's interesting that Washington dropped it. Other states may or may not have.
All of our
but,
states.
But, you know, Oregon ends up, Oregon ratepayers end up supporting green power across the entire grid is a concern I have.
Okay. Anything else, sir?
If I may, I'm Mark Elbert from Vulcan Power Company. And one example that I think might be useful in this argument is the argument of, I think there's, of if PGE, which is strictly an Oregon utility, wanted to build or purchase power from out of state, and they built a plant, a wind plant in Montana. They would charge all of those costs for that, and they sold all of that power to Oregon, their Oregon customers, because those are the only customers they have. They would go to the Oregon Public Utility Commission and recover those rates, that even though the plant was built in another state. I think the argument is similar for PacifiCorp. If PacifiCorp built a plant in Utah and 100% of that power is dedicated to Oregon, it's no different than PGE. PGE recovered all of their rates in Oregon for building a plant out of state just because this bill required them to. So should PacifiCorp be allowed to recover the rates, excuse me, the costs within their rates for the plant built outside of the state as long as the power is being sold to Oregon? If it's not being sold to Oregon, then I agree with your point. But if it's being sold completely to their Oregon customers, they should be treated just like an Oregon dealer.
The difference being this is more expensive power and it's something that's being required only in Oregon. That's different.
Sorry, can you say it again?
This is more expensive power, no matter where it's built. If no other state passed a regulation like this, it would only be sold in Oregon.
Yes, if I'm sold in Oregon.
That's my point.
I think, Representative, the proponents of this bill are claiming that this will provide some price stability over time in the marketplace.
Sir, could I get you to repeat your name for the record, please?
Mark Elbert, ALBGOT, Vulcan Power Company.
Any other questions for Representative Crummell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm just curious, when we're looking at 8 cents a kilowatt hour and 25 cents a kilowatt hour, and that is a wholesale price, what's that going to translate into a retail price by the time I get the power at my house, or anybody else in this room gets the power at their house?
Yeah, if I may, Representative Crummell, that probably is better addressed to either a PUC technician or an electric company technician. We are poor, simple folks who are trying to produce green power, we're unable to answer that question.
Because I'm just curious as to, and maybe when the fellow from the PUC or whoever comes up, they can answer this, because I'm just curious that it, and I don't think we are paying, at least I don't think I'm paying two or 3 cents a kilowatt hour, and if I am, it's gone up. But if that's what we're paying now and that's a retail price, it leads me to question, you know, what's the power company paying for it in their generation and so on. Is this really an attempt to follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair? Is this really kind of an attempt to see if we can create a market where there isn't one right now using government regulation?
I believe that's one perspective that people could have on it, certainly. Because the price of the renewable energy has historically been above the cost of hydro, the marketplace hasn't acquired the renewable energy. The discussions with the utilities about get some rate stability by bringing renewable energy online has not brought a lot of renewable energy online. This is an approach to where government gives the utilities a little nudge to get out in the marketplace and start making these renewable energy projects viable before the price of energy increases enough that brings them on automatically. Now, if you're following it with as the price goes up, you'll see more and more of these projects getting started. But this legislation nudges it along. Several other states have already adopted or are considering very similar legislation because they believe over the long term, it'll bring some price stability to their energy supply.
Okay. Another question, Mr.
Yep.
You had, Mr. Alberts, is it? You had commented, or one of you had commented about, you know, if you were building a plant in, you know, Montana or Utah or somewhere else. Given the fact that, I don't remember a lot from physics, but the one thing I do remember is that over a space of time, or excuse me, a space of distance, power tends to bleed off, or you lose a certain amount through the lines. That being the case, and I understand these lines are gigantic and everything, but that being the case, why would a company build a plant in, say, Utah or Idaho or Montana if they were going to sell 100% of their power to Oregon? And then that sort of brings up the secondary question, which is, assuming that if they were not selling 100% of the power to Oregon, but they were in fact selling it to other parts of the West, but we were the only state that was allowing them to recapture their cost based on a prudent investment, as is pointed out in this amendment. Why would we want to do that? Why would they want to sell 100% to Oregon? Secondly, if they are selling it to somewhere else, then why would we want to allow them to basically be charging the Oregon customers when they're not charging the other customers?
Okay.
Commissioner Kimmel, the answer to the first part of your question is, yes, there's load loss from transmission of long distances, and they may lose 10% of the power along the way. But if the utility or the company happens to own a wind site in Montana that blows 30% more often than a site they have in Oregon, then it makes more, it's all economics. They can make more power cheaper in Montana, and they can withstand the loss of 10% if they can make 30% more for the same infrastructure cost. So it is cheaper per kilowatt hour to get it back to Oregon. Same can be said for geothermal and other areas where, you know, a lot of the prime geothermal locations are in the Oregon Cascades, are in Nevada, and sometimes it's, if you have hotter water out of state, then sometimes they may decide to drill where the hotter water is for geothermal because they can generate the power cheaper and deal with the accepted losses.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of going to the source where you can get the power
absolutely
as inexpensively as possible.
Absolutely. And there are vast sources of all of these resources within Oregon. We fully expect a lot of these resources to be built in Oregon, and particularly in rural Oregon, where a lot of these rural development issues could be key. But that we're not requiring utilities to build in Oregon because we want. There's a certain theory that if you allow them to build where they want to build, then the most efficient resources get built quickest, which helps keep rates lower. I believe in response to your second issue, as to why would utilities, why should the Oregon PUC, well, first of all, why would utilities sell to Oregon if they were the only ones recovering rates? And second of all, why should the Oregon PUC recover their rates if they're not selling it in Oregon? I believe those are your questions. The answer is, the second part is we shouldn't. I believe this is the discussion we had earlier. We should only, the Oregon PUC should only be required to reimburse or cover the costs of the power plant as it relates to power sold in Oregon. If PacifiCorp, as the example is here, builds a plant in Utah, but they don't sell the power here in Oregon, that doesn't mean this bill does not say that the Oregon PUC is required to cover their costs. This bill only allows utilities to recover, or PacifiCorp essentially to recover the costs of that they spend in order to meet the provisions of this bill. And they only meet the provisions of this bill if electricity is sold in the state.
Can you tell me where it says that in the bill?
Sure.
That it's only if it's sold in the state?
17 and 18 on page 2.
Okay. 17, well, but I think that more...
Page 2, lines 17 and 18, the commission shall allow the provider to recover those disallowed expenditures in the rates established for Oregon customers of the provider.
Well, but if you read before that, what it says that an electricity provider supplying electric power in more than one state has made prudent expenditures in another state to produce or acquire non-hydroelectric new renewable energy to meet requirements of this section, and the commission that regulates a provider in the other state does not allow any portion of those expenditures to be recovered in the rates charged by the provider in the other state, the commission shall allow the provider to recover those disallowed expenditures in the rates established for the Oregon customers of the provider. It doesn't say anything about the fact that the power from that state has to arrive here. It says that you can recover your costs wherever you can recover them from.
Representative, I'm reading it differently. If you go up to line 13, 12-13, it says, prudent expenditures in another state to produce or acquire non-hydro renewable energy to meet the requirements of this section. So to meet the requirements of selling a certain, the requirements of the incumbent utility to sell a certain percentage of their power being non-renewable hydro.
But where does it say in this section that it has to be, that it has to be Oregon customers?
To meet the requirements of this section, which relates to sale by these utilities to Oregon customers.
I don't know. I don't see anywhere in the section where it says that it has to be, if it's generated, it can be generated. I don't care if you generate it in Scotland, for crying out loud, if it's sold, if it's used here in Oregon. But what this does not say anything about it being sold here in Oregon. What it says is that they can recover their costs from Oregon customers irrespective of whether they use that power here in Oregon or
not.
Well,
it's relating to meeting the requirements of this section, and the requirements of the section are on page one. They're also in section three, and they say 4, 7, and 10% of the electricity provider shall ensure that not less than 10% of all electricity sold by the provider is generated by non-hydro renewable energy sources. That's what I tie it back to, is the requirements of the section. Is that the way you understand it, Fred?
That's exactly the way we understand it. I am not the author of this provision, but that's the way we understand it works.
Representative Garrard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In his opening remarks, Mr. Clem indicated that there would be primarily three providers presently in the state that would benefit from this. Could you name those three?
Three that it would essentially affect. The bill, as we understand it, essentially affects Scottish Power and Pacific and PGE.
Those are the only ones.
That's our understanding.
Idaho Power is exempted from the bill in section 7.
Thanks.
And there are only three investor-owned utilities in the state. So that means the only two that are left are PacifiCorp and or Scottish Power and PG. Unless you adopt the dash fours, then you bring the consumer owned utilities into the purview of the bill. Okay, thank you. We have Mr. Miller, please. Mr. Johnson with you, Mr. Miller. Feel free to come up together if you'd like.
All right. While he's coming, Representative Whit, I tipped off about this meeting today, and I came along with Carl.
Mr. Miller, state your name for the record, please.
Yes, James R. Miller, Portland, Oregon. I'm more concerned about Measure 7. It's going to be discussed on Wednesday because we have a property that's present time not permissible to operate as geothermal, but it's the finest in the United States. Not commonly known. It's the first time this will be restated. And we have, well, Bonneville Power Administration made a study of 1,250 sites in the Northwest. It was Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Western Montana. And they came up with, the best site was found in Newberry Crater. Subsequent to that, the county commission over there closed things out. Also, the memorial was passed by the legislature. A lot of people spooked. The thing that caught us over there was they talked about the fact that we would have a rare pumice fern. Are you representative not from Deschutes County?
Good afternoon. Yes,
sir. I thought you were. And the rare pumice fern is not found except in very rare instances. It would only be hurt by snowmobilers and horses, which they use a lot. The second thing was, believe it or not, because the pine is dependent on snowmobilers a lot. Snowmobiling exists throughout the state of Oregon and Washington places. Matter of fact, it's surprising that they would get help from some of these other people because normally the environmentalists were against snowmobilers and they'd been forced out of Crater Lake. And we had no problem with that because they made statements, they sent letters from all over the Northwest that there'd be snowmobiles there'd be pipes on the top of the ground and everything in this category. It was all total misrepresentations. This is when Troop and Tuttle were there, and they didn't even look at the data we submitted on the day they had the hearing. And I brought a man in from the geothermal industry in Reno to look at it, and he said, nobody's looked at your material. Well, we knew that until this, and they hadn't even looked at a plant anyplace. Pauline, whatever her name was, did go down later on to look at some in Reno, which was out. So what they did is they froze out the finest geothermal property in the United States. I say that for this reason. It exists in the top of the central pumice cone. It is not visible from Paulina Peak. It's 250 feet below the, to the top of that, the floor of the crater. We have a road that goes right to it. The Mid-State Power has an easement provided by the Forest Service, 13-foot wide easement that goes right down to the main power lines of EPA. So it's all present there. But the problem with the geothermal industry is that they were seeking to get anything they could get, and they were leases once granted in the crater. They were closed out, and they were given leases outside the crater itself. And this was a problem where they, most of the people in the geothermal industry have some real handicaps. Wind power you can put any place. Put it on private land. With geothermal power, you're pretty much dealing with state or federal lands. How many private lands have got geothermal? So the net result, they're all clamoring and trying to get there first. A little bit of cannibalism in the industry because of it. We were small, set aside, was originally the property of stake for pumice, one of the two finest pumice properties in the United States, along with what's down in Medicine Lake. Then they found geothermal, and they drilled on our property, and then we got the patent. I represented these people originally on their pumice, and the man that had it was a man in Bend years ago that sold the one that was out at Tumalo, and he was killed. And that property was he had bought it and staked it in about the 30s. Somebody contested to jump these claims. He prevailed. The widow in 1967 decided to patent it. She won for the administrative judge for the Department of Interior. And then they decided to appeal it. Now, this is 67. Then bring it up again until 79. 79, they sent somebody over that just canceled the whole thing out. They turned everybody loose on it like they did at Bachelor. You remember when they wanted to put the new ski line up there? They had a big battle on that thing. And one of these fellows that's constantly involved in things and Ben made the statement he could never look at Mount Bachelor again. But we realized we couldn't fight this thing until we got some things straightened out. Measure 7 offers us some possibilities.
Mr. Miller,
yeah.
If you can try to keep your comments to the bill here that we're considering.
I will. Okay, I'll
say. Okay, we're not dealing with Measure 7
I'll say just one thing. I want to get the opportunity today to acquaint you with the fact there's a lot of geothermal. In addition to what Vulcan told you here, they have made studies and figure that the crater at Newberry has 13,000 to 16,000 megawatts. Now put that in your bonnet. That's equivalent to 10 Bonneville dams. But that means going into the crater itself. So there's a tremendous resource. Some of the geothermal people said geothermal is going to find its success in Oregon by what they do at Newberry Crater. But Vulcan and we have different situations. But I think today, just to get the announcement out, people have forgotten what there is at Newberry. And you're talking about the greatest geothermal resource in the United States. It's the hottest temperature. There's the shallowest depth.
Are you supportive of this bill, Mr. Miller?
Yeah, well, I see here. I think, let me put it this way. You need some incentives, and geothermal right now, originally I think Bonneville made the deal with Cal Energy at about 6.5 to 10 cents. So, and that's what Bonneville was going to pay to get Cal Energy in production. So the figures in here, they're pretty representative, I would say. And you're surely representative on solar energy. Everybody talks solar energy. It isn't feasible in the Northwest, other than on top of a telephone pole where you're going to like get enough energy to run a radio or something. You've got to go to the Mojave Desert. And both wind energy and solar energy are interruptible. They don't work when the wind doesn't blow or the sun does now. So geothermal energy is one of the greatest things in Oregon, and what he's talking about here, Vulcan, is one that's making another test at it. And frankly, if you look at the scope of the Pacific, geothermal follows the borders of the Pacific Ocean. That's what they call a fire ring. All right, and in the United States, the state of Oregon's got more volcanics than Washington or California. And Deschutes County has more than any county in Oregon. But it's hard to find these things because you go through a cold zone. When you drill, you go through glaciated water that's down, and it costs a lot of money to test that. That's why Newberry Crater is as important as it is. It's there and known. And I just point you again that geothermal energy has a lot of potential, and this could be very favorable for it.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Let's hear from Mr. Johnson, then we'll see if there's any questions.
My name is Carl Johnson, and I'm an interested citizen. And I think it's commendable that you're doing this to hopefully increase the use of green power. I personally hate to see creating gas plants when we can't have good renewable energy. But I noticed that in this book on geology, it's about regulatory guide leasing in these four states for geothermal. But back in 74, the legislature directed the Department of Energy to determine those sites that were unsuitable for geothermal, of all things. So the next year, what did they say? Department of Energy then said Newberry was unsuitable for anything. But may I read just one sentence and then I'll close.
Sure.
The council in 75 ruled because of high recreational use and lack of roads, geothermal power plants greater than 25 megawatts could not be constructed in Newberry Crater. That's untrue, I think. Test drilling continued, but the ruling deterred development in this area, which has since been designated a national monument. The monument surrounds it, but still private property. So that and goal five, because I followed LCDC and different requirements at the local level. I never understood why Deschutes County can't interpret goal five to say that this is a natural resource, we should develop it instead of blocking it off.
So, Mr. Johnson, you're supportive of this bill?
Definitely.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Questions for Mr. Miller or Mr. Johnson? Okay, thank you. We appreciate you coming and offering your experience and insight on this.
Yeah.
Thank you. Can we have Lee Sparling, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Lee Sparling. I'm administrator of the Electric and Natural Gas Division at the PUC. What I'd like to do is tell you very briefly what the commission's position on the concept in this bill is, and then offer a few comments on the Dash 4 and Dash 5 amendments, and then try to answer some of the questions that have come up and anything else you may have. The commission supports development of cost-effective renewables, but doesn't think the approach in this bill is the right way to do it. Instead, the commission thinks that pursuing the public purposes approach that is outlined now in Senate Bill 1149 is the way to support the development of renewables. Furthermore, even without the public purposes fund in Senate Bill 1149, the commission believes that the planning process that it has already in place is the way to identify the right amount of cost-effective renewable resources that a utility should acquire. Those planning processes in recent years have focused mainly on purchase power as the way to meet growing needs, but I suspect that any planning process right now would identify quite a bit more in the way of renewables as the way to meet the needs of PGE and PacifiCorp customers. Now, with respect to the Dash 4 amendments, the commission did discuss the point that Representative Monis Anderson made that if it's good public policy for PGE and PacifiCorp to have this kind of a requirement, then why isn't that also the case with respect to the other utilities in the state? However, the commission decided not to take a position on the Dash 4 amendments because the commission doesn't have any real regulatory authority over rates and most matters of the consumer-owned utilities, so we figured that we would stay out of their business in this particular instance. With respect to the Dash 5 amendments, the commission has not had a chance to discuss these amendments. We only saw them just this afternoon, but there are some points about them that I would like to raise. First of all, Chair Witt is correct in indicating that it really only applies to PGE and PacifiCorp. There is some language on line 6 about electricity service suppliers, which at first blush looks like it might pull in some other folks, such as PG&E National Energy Group, which has been involved in all the SB 1149 discussions about perhaps being an electricity service supplier that would serve customers under direct access. But I think as a practical matter, if you look at the exemption in Section 7, not only would that apply to Idaho Power Company, but it would probably also take care of most of the ESSs, as they're called, for some period of time. If we get to a point where ESS is, any particular one is serving a large number of customers, or if we get to a point where they're serving any residential customers, and that, of course, is not even contemplated under 1149 at this point, then this might apply. But for all practical purposes, this really does just apply to PG&E and PacifiCorp. In Section 3, there are a number of, and actually this is language from the original bill. I'm not at this point focusing on something new that's come up in the Dash 5 amendments. Section 3 refers to 4%, 7%, 10% of all electricity sold by the provider. So the one thing that's not specified there is whether we're talking about sales to retail customers in Oregon. As written, it could apply to wholesale transactions. As written, it could apply to all the sales that PacifiCorp makes in its other jurisdictions. If applied that way, since Oregon represents about one-third of PacifiCorp's retail sales throughout its many states, then the 10% requirement that's shown on line 16 would translate into 30% for 30% of sales to Oregon customers. If this goes forward in any form, that's probably an issue that warrants some further attention.
Could you go over that again, please?
The language, I'll take the initial specification of the percentage, which is on line 9 and 10.
Of the bill?
Of the Dash 5 amendments.
All right.
This is also language in the original bill, but let's look at the Dash 5 amendments. It says not less than 4% of all electricity sold by the provider. Well, I would interpret that as a requirement that we look at how much that utility sells, and in this case, that could apply to just their retail sales in Oregon, or that language, if it's not specified, could also be interpreted to mean that includes wholesale transactions where PacifiCorp or PGE is making sales of electricity to other utilities. It could also, in the case of PacifiCorp, apply to sales to its retail customers in Utah. The point is simply that the bill doesn't specify what electricity sold by the provider means. I suspect the intention was electricity sold by the provider to retail customers in Oregon. If that was the intention, that's probably a fairly simple fix.
So that would, the language after provider to retail Oregon customers would probably solve that?
Yes, it would.
Okay, thank you.
That way, Chair Witt, I would, as a practical matter, take a look at what the sales to Oregon retail customers are and take the appropriate percentage of that, and by that means determine how many megawatt hours of the non-hydro renewables would be required under the bill. With respect to the Dash 5 amendments, there's been some discussion about Section 3, sub 4, which begins on line 10 of page 2. I understand that the purpose of that provision is to make sure that PacifiCorp is made whole if it gets adverse rate-making treatment in another state. I have two concerns about the language, though. One is that the process that PacifiCorp has, the agreements it has with its various states for allocating costs is very complicated. And without some more scrutiny by some other analysts and work with the company, I cannot tell you that the whole Pacific harmless is the only real effect that's addressed here. I simply can't tell through the allocation process whether this provision might shift more costs than we're anticipating to Oregon customers. Another concern I have about this provision is that, frankly, it invites the other state jurisdictions to disallow certain costs, knowing that Oregon will pick up the difference. I'm not suggesting that anything as blatant as that might occur, but in terms of the way another commission might lean and the incentive that PacifiCorp has to argue for cost recovery in those states, that's all affected by the language in this provision, which says that in the end, Oregon will pick up the cost if necessary. Now let me turn real quick to the question in particular that Representative Crummell asked about rates. There was some discussion about whether the rates are 2 or 3 cents or whether they're higher than that. I think some confusion about that arises because there's a difference as to whether we're talking about the generation component or whether we're talking about the entire rate. I would estimate that right now for PGE and Pacific Core, the average cost of generation that's in everybody's rates is about 3 cents. For residential customers, the overall rate is more like 5.5 to 6 cents, that difference being 2.5 to 3 cents worth of distribution costs, transmission and distribution costs. For an industrial customer, those transmission and distribution costs aren't as high, and so the overall rate for an industrial customer is probably like more like 4, 4.5 cents. There was also some discussion a few moments ago about where the electricity is sold. That's always a difficult discussion because, as I understand the way PacifiCorp operates its system, the power is simply generated and fed into its system, and you can't track it to its destination. You can't tell that a wind farm in a particular state generates the electricity and it shows up at your home in Oregon. That creates a number of problems when you try to track that power and make sure that it doesn't get sold more than once. If a utility has some green resources, it can tell you that it has sold your green power, but it could be selling the same green power to someone else simply because it's not possible to track the electrons. Now, there are a number of efforts to, if you will, tag those electrons or tag those sales so they can't be made more than once, but that is one of the problems with the fact that when the power is generated, it's fed into a system, and in the case of Pacific, where it's operated as a system, you can't tell where it's going. That's all I have, Chair Witt. If you have any questions, I'd be pleased to try to answer them.
So you think this bill needs some technical cleanups, specifically on page 1, section 3, to make it clear that we're talking about power that is being provided specifically to retail Oregon customers?
Chair Witt, yes, that's correct. And also, there is one other technical change I'd suggest, and that is in section 5 on page 3, line 5. I'm not sure what the significance of the word immediately is. I'm just not sure what that would hold the commission to if someone filed that we're supposed to immediately allow the provider to charge.
What do you take it to mean?
I don't know whether that abrogates any of the process we have for notice and comment and potential hearings to determine what the incremental cost. I think expeditiously would probably be a better word than immediately.
Okay. And then on page 2, you have concerns relative to section 3, paragraph 4, in terms of clarification on that, sounds like. Is that language you'd be, in terms of expressing your concerns, can you be a little more specific there?
Chair Witt, I don't have particular language to suggest. One of the concerns is simply that the establishment of a mechanism that says Oregon will pick up the costs in the end, I think makes it a little easier for a commission in another state to say, well, we didn't ask for it, we don't want to pay for it, so we're not going to pay for it.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how to fix that without removing the provision altogether.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Sparling? Representative Johnson?
Thank you. Mr. Sparling, on page 3, section 5, where you just were, do you find that to be a consumer-friendly section? Particularly given that I have read information that suggests geothermal is particularly expensive to develop.
Chair Witt, Representative Johnson, I'm not sure whether consumer-friendly is the right term or not. As I indicated in my very first comments, I think the Commission's preference here is to use a planning process which identifies what the cheapest resources are that can be acquired to meet customers' needs. In that planning process, we do try to recognize the benefits of renewables versus conventional resources like gas-fired resources. And that analysis would recognize the benefits that have been alluded to today in the terms of the fact that renewable resources tend to have no fuel costs, if you will. A wind project, for example, doesn't have fuel costs per se. It also tries to recognize the potential benefits that these resources bring in avoiding any global warming concerns. But overall, the commission's preference would be to find the cheapest resource, recognizing the benefits, and therefore finds that process more attractive than one that mandates a specific level of renewables.
Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Sparling? President Crummell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you think that this bill create, and I don't know, maybe I'm just asking the question a different way than Representative Johnson did, but do you think that this bill creates an unfair advantage for a company that gets into using the public purpose charge monies that have been collected, while others might be left there to the market for whatever venture capital they're able to obtain?
Chair Witt, Representative Crummell, I'm not sure unfair advantage is the right term to use. Even under this approach or under the public purposes approach as provided in Senate Bill 1149, I presume that possible suppliers would compete for funding. They would compete in the public purposes situation by requesting funds from the organization that is being developed to disperse the funds, the Energy Trust of Oregon. Under this mechanism, I assume that the utilities would run some kind of a competitive bidding process, perhaps, to acquire the amount of power necessary, or they'd be shopping out in the market to the extent a green market develops out in the wholesale market. Whether someone who wins that has an unfair advantage, I can't really say.
Okay. Based on some comments that you made earlier, would you say that it's safe to assume that green power should probably be generated in the state in which it's, sold in the state in which it's generated? I mean, since you can't really track the electrons from one point to another.
Chair Witt, Representative Crummell, it depends on the benefits of renewables that you're after. If you're looking for local economic effects associated with the resource, whether it's renewables or otherwise, then you'd want it located in the state. If you're looking for the benefits of renewables in terms of the stability of the costs associated with it, I don't think it really matters in the case of a multi-jurisdictional utility like PacifiCorp. I'm not sure whether it matters where it's sold as long as that price effect, the stabilizing effect, is reflected in the method of allocating costs across the states. And in the case of PacifiCorp, I think it probably would. And in the case of Portland General Electric, for example, I think the fact that PGE buys any renewables in terms of that stabilizing effect probably benefits all its customers.
And I think lastly, anyway, looking at Section 5 and on page 3, particularly lines 10, 11, 12, and 13, and I don't know if this is a sort of another way of asking Representative Johnson's question or not, but the whole section, would you say that that is sort of giving the provider kind of a carte blanche as far as what they can request and what they can get reimbursed for? I don't know if that's the right term or not.
Chair Witt, Representative Crummell, no, I don't think it really does that. I don't think that's the intention. Determining the actual incremental cost of buying and delivering the electricity will be fairly complicated. It's not just a matter of looking at the contract price of 7.9 cents a kilowatt hour for the wind. You have to go through some analysis to figure out exactly how that affects the company's overall power supply operations and figure out that incremental cost. I think the language that may be causing some trouble is this language about without a review of the electricity provider's earnings. And I think that is largely a matter of directing the commission in this circumstance not to review what the right authorized rate of return should be for the company, whether that should be updated because interest rates have changed, and then also not to look at the company's earnings. If they happen to be earning at a relatively healthy pace, some might argue, well, why shouldn't the company absorb the cost of those renewable resources? On the other hand, if they're not earning so well, that's, again, something that we're directed not to take into account here. So I don't think it gives the provider carte blanche to ask for anything that it wants. It will still have to justify that those are, in fact, the additional costs.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? Thank you, Mr. Farley. Anybody else who'd like to give testimony on House Bill 3799?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sandy Flicker with the Oregon Rural Electric Co-op Association, and with me is Tom O'Connor with the Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities, and Robin Freeman with the Oregon People's Utility District Association. We just wanted to very briefly comment on the Dash 4 amendments. Representative Knope already gave some good comments on why the Dash 4 amendments don't work, but I thought I would just add a little more flesh to the bones of those comments. We are opposed to the Dash 4 amendments for the following reason. As of October 1, 2001, all of the consumer-owned utilities will be purchasing 100% of their power from the Bonneville Power Administration as full requirements customers, and we will be buying renewable power through BPA. If you change their status as a full requirements customer with this mandate, you potentially add cost to their operation that you might not foresee. If you require them to buy 4% of their power from a source other than BPA, they would be subject to additional fees from BPA for ancillary services such as load shaping, transmission access, follow-on power. The co-ops have been planning for their power purchases, the consumer-owned utilities have all been planning for their power purchases for the past 2 years, and they have now signed 10-year contracts with BPA. So the mandates for renewable power in the Dash 4 amendments simply are not feasible for the consumer-owned utilities. They do have their own renewable programs that exist already, and many consumer-owned utilities buy the environmentally preferred power through BPA. And just a final comment, and that is that the consumer-owned utilities, as you all know, will be experiencing a potential 100% rate increase next fall because of an exorbitant increase in the BPA wholesale power that could be as high as 300%. Now is not the time to add additional cost to that with the renewables mandate. That is very impractical for consumer-owned utilities at best and very cost-insensitive at this time. So I just wanted to make sure we clarified our opposition to the Dash 4 amendment.
So you're not opposed to the bill, Sandy, just to the Dash 4?
We are neutral. Speaking for the co-ops, we have no position on the bill as it doesn't impact us, the original bill. Only we're opposed to the Dash 4 amendment.
You can assure us if we pass the bill with Dash 5s, you won't be back in 2 years opposing implementation of it.
I'm Mr. Chairman, I can't assure you of anything in 2 years from now. I wish I could, but I can't. And I'm not sure if it's done. Okay. Thank you very much.
Great. Any questions? Okay, thank you. Anybody else who wants to give testimony on House Bill 3799? If not, I will close the public hearing. And Wednesday, we have several bills up. Dan will be posting tomorrow morning. It'll be an important meeting Wednesday. I think we've got, five or six bills?
Six.
Six bills, so we'll be somewhat busy on Wednesday, committee, so I would encourage you to try to be here on time and come prepared. If you have any questions, feel free to see me. Thank you. We are adjourned.